This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
My talk is called Practical and Non-Practical Guilt and the Role of Institutions. This is rather an old-fashioned talk, as in perhaps might be appropriate more 10 years ago than today. It's also a talk that I'm mostly going to read, but if we wanted to update it just a little bit, I suggest you all think warm feelings and maybe give each other a hug or something to get the oxytocin going here. That will no doubt improve the value of the talk somewhat. Anyway, my topic throughout is, there is a handout also, if you haven't got that, you might want it. My topic throughout is guilty feelings, rather than guilt as a judicial matter, though we would hope that these two aspects of guilt are not wholly distinct. So that's to bound the topic, and I'll start by saying, as comedians, novels, and Sally Struthers occasionally remind us, it is possible to feel guilty about a lot of things besides one's own wrongdoing. One can feel guilty for, say, indulging in small pleasures when someone a world away is doing much more poorly than oneself. One can feel guilty for the bad deeds of others before one's own birth. One can feel guilty for playing an innocent causal role in the misfortunes of others. Or one can even feel guilty for various sorts of good fortune, especially when others are less lucky. While I would hold that there are limits to the possible sources of guilt, nonetheless, it seems to be a rather promiscuous emotion. In this talk, I will distinguish between two broad varieties of guilt feelings based on the degree to which they provide guidance for actions, and further distinguish one of them, which I'll call non-practical guilt, to elucidate some instances in which one might feel guilty because of factors that are utterly beyond the ability of even scrupulously ethical actors to avoid. I will try to make sense of the reasonability of such extremely non-practical guilt feelings and suggest that while good institutional design and implementation may reduce their frequency and perhaps their severity, we should expect them to recur as a kind of ethical remainder, because even the best ethical principles and practices cannot fully eliminate their basis. This analysis will help me make sense of such feelings as consistent with more ordinary practical guilt feelings, and rebuts the charge that such feelings are irrational simply because they sometimes run contrary to our other ethical judgments. I'll start by dividing the occasions for guilty feelings into two rough categories: things that are or were within an individual's power to affect or alter, and things which are not or were not within an individual's power to affect or alter. To avoid feeling guilty for outcomes within one's own power to control, one need only act appropriately, or so it seems. Or, after one has incurred such guilt through bad or incautious action, one might lessen or remove such guilty feelings by remedial action. By virtue of their close connection to an agent's actions, I'll call these guilty feelings practical guilt. But, of course, as I mentioned, one may also feel guilty for things not so closely connected to what one has or has not done. For instance, one may feel guilt for what one's ancestors or countrymen have done long before one's birth. I'll call this vicarious guilt. One may also feel guilty about things that happened as a result of one's activities, though such events were unforeseeable as a result of one's actions, and one was blameless in what one did. Call this bad luck guilt. One may feel guilty and tainted by having benefited from the misfortunes of others, or from being lucky when others weren't, though such benefits may have been bestowed without one's consent or active participation. I'll call this good luck guilt. Altogether, I'll call these and certain other species of guilty feelings non-practical guilt, given that one can be susceptible to them independently of any particular practical choices one might make. Although they differ with respect to guiding individual actions, both practical and non-practical guilt may be defended as rational, at least much of the time. To explain the existence of ordinary practical guilt, sociobiologists might point us to the fact that it provides incentivizing guidance to individuals to act in ways that are socially responsible. Non-practical guilt does not do this directly, hence its name. Yet, there still seem to be good reasons to suppose that even these guilty feelings are potential signals of a sort of ethical failing in the world, and therefore may have some functional explanation. They are usually, say, occasioned by harms or potential harms to others, which may well have been prevented had the world been differently ordered, or had those in a position to assist done so. Even if one could not have prevented some situation in which one suffers from feelings of non-practical guilt, the possibility of non-practical guilt might prompt individuals to look for, say, institutional or retroactive responses to the harms that prompt guilt feelings. For instance, a society like ours performs a variety of functions through government and social institutions that are designed to alleviate poverty, to protect the public's health, to lower risks from unsafe products and activities, and to provide, say, childhood education and nurturing to a point at which a person will be able to fend for herself. They may also attempt to remedy or ameliorate effects of past injustices on those who were harmed, or even on their survivors. These social institutions may not work perfectly, but in general, they are believed to make life better for us, and in particular, for members of society whose own means would not allow them to secure these benefits for themselves. For some things, such as public health, the group of beneficiaries may include almost all of us. For others, such as poverty programs or education, it may be a relatively smaller fraction of society that benefits more than they would under a system in which only individual or small collective responses were relied upon, a Nozickian world, if you will. Although humans have long constructed institutions to serve such purposes, I think it is widely acknowledged that their role has expanded considerably during the 20th century, and that their role in a well-governed society can be largely positive with respect to reducing the strong harms that often occasion guilt. Actual institutions are always something less than perfect, and so one will expect that any institutional scheme we put in place will leave some people worse off than they have a right to be, or will distribute resources less efficiently than is possible, such that we could, in theory, perhaps make Pareto-optimizing improvements in the situation of some people in need through better institutional design. But for the remainder of this paper, I'm going to imagine that we live in a state and in a world in which the public institutions have been designed and implemented in ways that make them as effective and just as is possible, for humans to do anyway, and thus that no alteration in their design or implementation will, on balance, right more injustices or improve the welfare of people when compared to the system already in place. By reflecting on this idealized situation, I think we will be able to investigate the ways in which even less perfect institutions can and or should diminish our tendency to feel non-practical guilt. All right. So that's all by way of introduction to the topic and just the general framing of it. The remainder of the talk is organized around providing answers to the following four questions, which I've printed on your handout. One. Would ideally constructed institutions in fact serve to lessen or de-rationalize non-practical guilt? Two, is it reasonable to expect that non-practical guilt will remain even if one's social institutions are maximally efficient and just? Three, if so, would such guilt at that point be irrational? And four, if such residual non-practical guilt would not be irrational, what can we learn about ethics and institutions from the existence of such guilt feelings? I've hinted at or gestured at the answers to three of those questions. The last one will end up being something of an open question at the end, but you can hopefully gain some insight into how we might go about thinking about it. In response to the first question, there is every reason to think that well-designed, responsive institutions can reduce the underlying causes and frequency of non-practical guilt. Take, for instance, survivor guilt. This sort of feeling arises when a person escapes harm that befalls others less lucky. When occasions for such guilt cannot be eliminated entirely, while occasions for such guilt cannot be eliminated entirely, it would seem that such mundane public programs such as consumer product and transportation safety regimes can reduce the extent to which people succumb to accidents, and thus the frequency with which individuals end up differentially lucky in the wake of such accidents. Public institutions can also serve as a means to remedy past injustices of the sort that lead to vicarious guilt now. While no individual can make up for the wrongdoings of her group against another group, it seems possible for her group to act in concert to put the things right with other groups who were badly treated by one's forebears. In so doing, members of the group who committed the wrongful acts can recognize that the grounds for further recriminations have been reduced. They may even take pride in having paid off an inherited debt instead of feeling guilty for the legacy they've inherited. A more interesting effect of institutions, and this is actually where this talk really started from, if you read an earlier abstract of what I thought I was going to talk about here today, this is thinking about how institutions may actually affect guilt in a very different sort of way. A more interesting effect of institutions is that they may clarify our responsibilities and abilities, and in so doing help bound and rationalize what can sometimes seem unlimited responsibilities to others. In effect, they can help one to see that what may appear to be grounds for practical guilt feelings are really factors beyond one's control, that is, non-practical, and therefore perhaps not grounds for guilt feelings at all. For instance, one might feel guilty if one is unable to provide as much of some good to one's loved ones as it seems that they require. Consider what it is like to be responsible for providing for the health care needs of a loved one in a medical crisis. It is genuinely awful to feel that there is more one can do to help a loved one in need and yet be constrained by either financial or practical limitations, say competing needs, from doing everything possible to help a loved one in crisis. But healthcare is, at any point in time, a relatively finite resource upon which many different parties may place demands and for which large social institutions are required to provide it in something more than a merely rudimentary fashion. Suppose such institutions were organized to provide care in an egalitarian, efficient, and largely sufficient manner, such that sick people would receive a level of care that is socially sustainable and largely sufficient for all but the most extreme needs, while all but disallowing private expenditures for care beyond these limits. This is a hypothetical, perfectly organized healthcare system, right? Since the system operates with maximum efficiency, allowing private claims on such resources for those in extreme need would necessarily take resources away from others equally deserving. If such a system were in place, it would seem that individuals would be relieved of much of the guilt, not to mention anxiety, that can come with being required to provide health care for loved ones. Not only would such a system provide most people with what they need in terms of care, but to the extent that it may fail to give someone what she needs, it displaces the blame for this failure from the loved ones to the system itself. And it justifies this failure by reference to the larger social good the system provides. Hence, such an institutional solution to healthcare, assuming it works as well as it possibly could abate many of the most worrisome sources of individual guilt, both practical and non-practical, associated with the care of others. Though it may not convince every individual that there is nothing more that he or she could have done or could do for a loved one with extreme health care needs, it may provide him or her with ethical justifications for failing to do more than the institution allows, since to do more than allowed would be to beggar others, which we may assume one has an obligation not to do. Whether or not one finds this idealized picture appealing, I think it's a direct and important consequence of the hypothesis I'm entertaining here, and one that can be invoked quite generally. If we craft institutions that yield maximum social utility and support just outcomes, or when these goals conflict, if they do, that achieve whatever the appropriate trade-off is between them, then many of the sorts of harms that give grounds for non-practical guilt will be alleviated. Moreover, it would seem, any further harms that remain would be beyond the ability of human agency to address, except at a cost in efficiency or justice, and an associated increase in the grounds for guilty feelings. Hence, I think, were we to put in place well-designed and implemented social institutions that are maximally efficient and just, and were they recognized as such, it would frequently be the case that we could avoid many of the non-practical guilt feelings to which we are otherwise susceptible. one would know that any remaining harms that cannot be addressed by individual or institutional efforts are no fault of the agent herself and are truly beyond redress. Any sort of guilt feelings for these harms would be non-practical in an extreme sense, and this is the sense I'm going to turn to now. I take it that this result would be a desirable outcome. But even if this is so, in answer to my second question, I would wager that it is likely that some of us would still find ourselves feeling guilty for some events beyond our practical reach in this extreme way. While such occurrences may be minimized by the existence of well-designed, optimally functioning institutions, they can't be eliminated, if only because some individuals will inevitably fall through the institutional cracks, so to speak. Even the best possible institutions will not likely be fail-safe. When one recognizes that one's social institutions have failed someone, feelings of guilt are not incomprehensible. This leads to my third question. What should we make of these feelings for what I will call extreme non-practical guilt? One option is to regard the assessment of them as guilt as a mistake by the person whose feelings they are, that they're not really guilt. Perhaps they should be understood as something like an impotent sympathy for the unfortunate instead of actual guilt. Yet I think that we can distinguish the sort of sadness mixed with relief that may accompany the thought, "There but for the grace of God go I," from the sense that one's own accomplishments and security are somehow tainted by the misfortunes of others. It is the sense of taint, that one's own worth is diminished as a result, that seems essential to the feelings of guilt, to the feeling of guilt. And I do think that one might well feel this sort of diminishment as a result of seeing someone who needs and deserves some particular service or remedy from one's common social institution, and yet who fails to receive that kind of service or remedy. If so, then I would count such feelings as guilt, or guilty feelings, if you will. A different sort of mistake might be alleged, namely, that the feeling of guilt is itself a kind of mistake. Perhaps in just cases, perhaps in just cases where it is non-practical, or perhaps even it's a mistake in all cases. For an example of someone who holds this view, very recently Gilbert Harman has argued that guilt feelings are inessential to moral motivation and are in fact a regrettable defect of those moral agents who feel them. Citing himself as an example of someone who has moral principles and is a relatively moral person, unquote, Harman nonetheless denies that he is susceptible to non-trivial guilt feelings. If he is right that guilt is not necessary for moral motivation, then feeling guilty would seem to be a crutch for those who lack other sufficient motivations to do what morality requires. At worst, it would seem to be counterproductive to the aims of morality, since it is a bad hedonistic state without point. Whether or not Harman is right about ordinary practical guilt feelings, this is certainly a tempting response to those cases where guilt carries with it no practical upshot, not even to reform institutions. That is what I'm calling extremely non-practical guilt. Of course, it may be that residual guilt feelings in these extremely non-practical circumstances are of a piece with those in the less extreme cases, and that altogether these feelings are what motivate people to seek and support institutional solutions to broad societal problems. Perhaps it is as a response to guilt feelings that individuals often demand that their states seek to promote social goals such as distributional justice and the redress of past wrongs. If so, then even some practical guilt, even if some non-practical guilt has no upshot, it may be continuous with other guilty feelings which do indeed motivate us, if not to individual action, then to collective action. So there may be no qualitative or phenomenological difference between guilty feelings that are completely useless and those that issue in support for institutional solutions to broader social problems. Still, if one is sophisticated enough to recognize this, then one should be able to appreciate Harman's argument. That is, suppose an agent regards an institution as having been designed and implemented as well as it can be, consistent with larger goals of utility maximization and justice. and suppose that such an institution nonetheless fails someone who needs and deserves its help. If an agent thinks that guilt feelings are to be justified exclusively by their functional role, then she should likewise deny that they are rational when they serve no positive purpose. And no sane person feels guilty about every occasion on which someone has suffered preventable harm or harm at the hands of others. If the functionality of guilt feelings is what makes them rational, then one should deny their rationality in those cases I'm describing as extremely non-practical. That is, those where an agent recognizes that they point in no action-guiding direction. So, either extremely non-practical guilt feelings are irrational, or we need some other explanation for their reasonability. In order to make a stab at explaining them, I will take some guidance from remarks that Herbert Morris made, and a much-discussed example of the phenomenon from Bernard Williams. Morris discusses guilt in many of its guises, and in particular what he calls non-moral guilt, which is close to but not quite exactly the same as what I'm talking about as non-practical. In writing about what it is to feel guilty, he says, and this long quote is on your handout at the bottom, "A person who is feeling guilt will be feeling bad because of a unique set of beliefs that allow us to define the feeling." And he gives a series of conditions here for what this feeling is involved, what beliefs are involved in this feeling, he says. First, one realizes that something one values has been damaged and that this thought alone causes some pain. Second, just as there is a special satisfaction attached to thinking of oneself as the creator of what is valuable, so a special dissatisfaction derives from the realization that one has oneself damaged or destroyed what one values. Third, in feeling guilty, one reproaches oneself in a manner that corresponds to the reproach one would have visited upon another had they been the responsible party. Fourth, part of one's feeling bad is accounted for by one's feeling apart from and separated from those to whom one was attached. And that's what I'll focus on ultimately. Finally, feeling guilty, we feel weighted down not just by these distressing feelings, but by a feeling of obligation as well, to confess, to make amends, to repair, and to restore. When all is said, then the state of the person feeling guilty implies a division within the person, a separation from others, and a need to put things right and together with oneself and with others. Now, within this, the second claim in the definition, which pertains more narrowly to what I've called practical guilt, so leaving that part of it aside as a part of the general thought, I'm going to focus on the other conditions. And at a great risk of a prioriism, I'll suggest that feelings of guilt are, at their most basic, manifestations of a sense of a disruption in one's ethical relations with others. Such disruptions can occur in many ways. One of the most common, right, is when one acts in a way that harms or disadvantages others, and in particular when that harm is not or cannot be recompensed. To cause a harm that cannot be repaired leaves a breach between oneself and one's victim that can continue to generate bad feelings indefinitely. If, say, the harm is merely property damage and one makes good on one's obligation, then the grounds for guilt largely disappear upon doing so. So it's that sort of continuing basis that's required for the ongoingness of it. Such breaches need not, however, always be attributed to one's own wrongdoings, nor even to one's own actions. A breach can arise when one's ethics and institutions, no matter how well developed and followed, leave a particular person or group out in the cold, so to speak, through bad luck, innocent mistake, or considerations of efficiency. If I am right that such outcomes, however regrettable, are nonetheless inevitable, then one may always be able to find grounds for guilt feelings that arise as a side effect of any set of ethical institutional arrangements. Even if one consistently does what is ethically best and supports ethically recommended institutions, this will not necessarily put one ethically square with everyone else. To take a simple example, no criminal justice system is entirely immune from false convictions. So everyone is likely to be a member of a society that at some point falsely convicts and sentences an innocent person. No matter how perfectly the rules were followed and how just this institution overall, the harm it does to the falsely convicted, I think, cannot be undone. We'll try to undo it, but it's still going to continue to be a real defect. Hence, such false convictions will remain a source of extremely non-practical guilt for all who are part of that system and its society. A more complicated and widely discussed example is provided by Bernard Williams in a famous rebuttal to J.J.C. Smart's defense of utilitarianism. Williams describes a scene in which Jim, a hapless North American botanist, wanders into a dicey situation in a South American village. Jim encounters a military unit which is lined up and is preparing to execute a group of 20 poor villagers. The colonel in charge of the unit, recognizing Jim as a foreigner, takes an interest in him and makes him the following proposition. If Jim will shoot one of the villagers currently lined up, the colonel will turn the other 19 free. Otherwise, Jim is free to go about his business, in which case the colonel indicates that he will proceed with the lot of executions as originally planned. The people assembled, including the potential targets, appear eager for Jim to accept the colonel's offer. Williams uses this case to make a point about a defect in the consequentialism underlying most varieties of utilitarianism. Williams argues that from the consequentialist's perspective, Jim's decision is a no-brainer. In shooting the one, Jim vastly decreases the overall amount of harm done and thus is obligated to do it. While Williams does not, in fact, say what he thinks Jim should do, his complaint is not that consequentialism gets the wrong answer, but that it seems to have no way to account for our sense that Jim is in a predicament, and that he would have strong grounds for feeling guilty, no matter which choice he made. Now, Williams doesn't talk in terms of guilt here, but I'm going to glide over that fact. At best, it seems, consequentialism would count such feelings as a psychological quirk, and, as Harmon appears to believe, one that an agent should get over if one is able to do. Following Morris, and in light of the analysis above, I would draw a different lesson. When a person is, like Jim, forced into making a tragic sort of choice, either branch of which will tie her indelibly to grave harm to others, there is reason to expect her to feel significant guilt due to the breach such a choice creates between her and those who are harmed as a result. Such guilt tracks an ethical concern distinct from those which are highlighted by utilitarianism or theories of procedural or distributive justice. In other words, even if her action is mandated and justified by some wider abstract ethical theory, her responsibility for harms that flow directly from her choice is at best mitigated, but not eliminated. And the sense of guilt that comes from the harm one has wrought is likely to remain as well. If this much is right, or at least plausible, what does it tell us about ethics and social institutions? That's my final question. One thing, to reiterate a point made earlier, is that good institutional design and implementation may help to reduce the incidence of such tragic dilemmas and conflicts by increasing society's overall wealth and the roughly equitable distribution of it. When people are more rarely at risk of grave harm from poverty, disease, or accident, the choices of others will more rarely cause them to suffer such harms, thus reducing the occasions for such non-practical guilt feelings. So living in a just and prosperous society may give one fewer grounds for feelings of non-practical guilt. However, a second, less optimistic result is that even ideal institutions will not eliminate all possibilities for feelings of significant non-practical guilt. And sometimes those institutions themselves may be the occasions of such guilt. That's because acting within institutional constraints will sometimes require one to do things that do not accrue equally to everyone's benefit. In some cases, it may even cause one to harm some people, or at least fail to serve their interests as well as they serve the interests of others who are no more deserving. And if I am right, that guilt is tied to a sense of ethical connectedness, a sense that is ruptured when one agent harms another, and if this connectedness carries independent ethical weight that is not subsumable to concerns with overall utility or justice, then there may be occasions on which an agent may reasonably be inclined to act to preserve it, that is, preserve the connectedness, rather than to fulfill her institutional roles or broader, more abstract ethical obligations. I will not say that she should violate her institutional or ethical obligations, but only that she may reasonably expect to feel guiltier for doing what ethics requires of her than doing what her conscience more viscerally demands. Thank you. Martha?
Iris Young's last book is all about this, so first of all, I think it would be a good thing to try to get the manuscript of that from Dave and read it. She makes a lot of the arguments that you go through here, but then she makes another one. I mean, she's concerned with what her bottom line is that we should focus on collective responsibility for the future and get rid of this guilt stuff. But the argument against guilt that she gives that you don't mention here, which I think is rather interesting, is that agents focus on their own possible guilt. There's going to be a blame game, as she puts it, that people will start accusing one another and saying, you're the one who really is responsible, no, you're the one, and they'll try to shift the blame in order to shift the guilt, and that will just lead to a useless debate, which really isn't productive for the future. So if we can just wipe out all that retrospective stuff and focus on what we can do in the future, that's more productive, is the basic idea.
Okay.
So I wonder what you think about that.
I think that all sounds right, except I guess what I would want to say is if this kind of analysis is fruitful and if people could be gotten to see this, then it might help reduce the blame game without, say, giving you fully justified leave to ignore the feelings that are natural when you see bad things happen to good people through no fault of anybody at all. So
I think that's right.
I'm sympathetic to the position, but I think that it would be a mistake, then push the point a little further, to suggest that if Iris Young is right, that would take, and we did what she said, that would take care of the feelings of guilt. Yes.
I wonder what you make of a kind of profoundly non-practical guilt, and that is a sense of original sin, right? In a sense that you're so inherently imperfect that no matter how much you try, that there's some falling short of some ideal standard. Do you think that is a purely irrational kind of feeling, or do you think that kind of existential guilt itself has some kind of value or some kind of function, either in terms of promoting personal transformation or maybe moving us beyond the plane of justice to some kind of higher plane of relationship to others?
Right. I don't have a good answer to that, except I want to say what I'm trying to do here is in some sense give a non-functional account of what's going on with guilt. And perhaps this is just autobiography, but having been brought up in a certain tradition where this is part of it, I actually think that the kind of humility that is suggested there is a good thing, but it doesn't necessarily lead directly to anything that you're supposed to do. It just suggests that, right, you always have reason to worry that, right, that you might be doing something wrong, and that to avoid a sense of self-aggrandizement and satisfaction that gives you likely to not care about certain things. So, is that accounted for by my account? I don't know, but I mean, it seems this is obviously coming out of a tradition in which this thought is taken seriously, and this is maybe a less metaphysically grounded way of capturing the same sort of impetus. Yes.
This may be just a sort of case that ratifies your whole project here, but exactly a week ago, I was in South Africa. South Africa, co-convening a conference on law, religion, and human rights, and lawyers from mostly South and West Africa. And I thought we would be talking about constitutions and legislation. We ended up spending a lot of time talking about witchcraft. And I was trying to get my mind around this and how we present this to our funders, but what is bothering me is that the two groups that are most likely to be accused of witchcraft in a number of African countries are children and the elderly. So I started thinking about, isn't this just a horrendous case of dependent groups and societies that are horribly torn, in Liberia and Congo were the most frequent places where this was cited. Of people unable to take care of the dependents in their society and pushing them off, and they're just sort of thrown out on the street. I mean, this is sort of parallel to the other use of witchcraft, which is more formal and involves trial by ordeal and all sorts of things. But so I really saw this as the problem of tremendous guilt amid serious deprivation. How are they going to get beyond that? The law be a solution?
I'm not why. I mean, I think that you're probably right that there's something similar involved here. I don't know how you convince people that they should give up their views about witchcraft, but it does seem like it is a response to a similar sort of feeling of helplessness, yet responsibility. And so, okay, well, one way to displace it is onto supernatural powers. The way I suggest would be to at least understand the things. I would take it that invoking and hoping for institutions to solve the problems is the more productive way of trying to deal with these sorts of feelings than to say, well, this is what has been ordained by mystical forces or some such, and therefore, and in keeping with the theme of the conference, this is a suggestion for here's the right way to go about it instead of this other way, but I don't have any further insight into that. Pardon?
I wonder if guilt is an information forcing. So the distinction between practical and non-practical guilt based on whether there are actions that can be taken to ameliorate the underlying cause, whether that doesn't assume away much of the value of the emotion, which would be to create an incentive to think about whether there are actions that can be taken to ameliorate the underlying cause.
So you're suggesting that when you're sitting there feeling guilty, there's some sense in which you are not doing what you ought
to do? There's some, that is an incentive for you to analyze the situation.
Right.
So, well, is there something I can do or not? I mean, mm-hmm. So you don't know
right.
sort of beforehand whether there's something you can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that seems good. So if there is such a thing as a non-functional rationality to this, a different way to put it might be to say that these kind of feelings have a way of organizing or orchestrating patterns of response in desiring, etc., that would be valuable as ethical states or as states of character. And so it's not practical in the sense of points you to particular action, but it is valuable in the sense of generates ways of approaching situations or dispositions to wait or something like that. And a related set of thoughts that are somewhere in the deep background of this is a sense of Harry Frankfurt used to write about higher and lower order desires, and it's really hard to make sense of higher order desires as being practical, but what they do tend to do is hang around and organize other kinds of desires. So their temporal status is that they have longer shelf lives and they don't necessarily always get invoked in every certain situation, but they tend to like creep up when situations call for them, right? So being disposed to feeling guilty is in some sense perhaps valuable, not because it leads to particular actions, but because it leads to certain sets of concerns.
So, I wonder if you might also want to think a little bit more of that responsibility and blame as aspects of guilt. These issues that you're raising are issues that come up a lot in terms of municipal and governmental liability, which is something I mm-hmm. think about a lot. And so, you know, you have a structure, for example, in which we can imagine municipal liability, but we also want to include individual liability at the same time, because we want to avoid a Nuremberg defense, right?
Okay.
You know, each person mm-hmm. should continue to be responsible, you know, even as the institution is forcing them into illegal conduct, let's say. But the issue of allocating responsibility, as in you really should not have taken that action and you should try to take it differently next time, supplemented by we should restructure the institution so you don't have to take it again next time, has a different valence than the argument about blame. You know, blame has a much more emotive component, which is also you're a really lousy kind of person for having done that, you know, and that bleeds into issues about malice of forethought and different kinds of intent. You know, there are lots of ways you can structure responsibility
right.
in which you encourage people to be sure not to take the action next time, and yet you don't blame them. Once you start blaming people, you get a whole different set of incentives and disincentives
mm-hmm.
You know, that you have to think about. So I wonder if that might be another way to sort of slice and dice these issues up.
Right. I guess I would say blame here is more of a judgment of a sort of judicial or ethical procedural sort And that's what where I'm just trying to focus on what would be the source of the feeling of guilt towards these towards other people, where I think that you can feel guilt for your own on your own behalf or on behalf of your institutions or ethics or your people, etc., without necessarily holding oneself to have, I mean, the point being, you don't have to say that you've acted wrongly or blame as in a judgment of here's somebody who has failed in a very particular sort of ethical way, but it's the sense in which if we have failed to do right by others more generally or to have brought about as good a state of affairs, then it seems reasonable to have this feeling without
I agree. You're talking about the internal feeling and blame has to do with the reaction to the feeling, but if we're talking about institutional design and ways of evoking and encouraging the feeling, then we do have to think about that reciprocal relationship, right, between what message you get back when you do something wrong and what you've done wrong. And all I'm saying is if we could inculcate different kinds of degrees of feelings of guilt, you know, there's a difference between you're a bad person for what you've done and within the strictures of this institution you could have done it differently. There are different moral values there.
Okay. I think I need to hear more about this. I don't think I'm getting it quite right, but I think that's just my failing right now. But let me hear more about that soon. Richard.
Yeah, I want to ask a question about the smart example and what it tells us about utilitarianism. And the word I would like to pick on is this idea that somehow or other utilitarian would say that you're obligated to engage in that act, which would save them 20 years, or let's say 19 if the cost of one. Well, I'm not aware of any legal system that would use the word obligated there. The word they would use is privileged or permitted to, justified in doing so in some sense. And one way to do this is to sort of ask whether the utilitarian feels the same way about that hypothetical as you do about the other one. The guy from the junta comes up and says, here are 20 revolutionaries who are about to shoot. If you kill yourself, I will release all of them. We assume there's no problem with enforcement and credibility. Does the utilitarian really require you to kill yourself under these circumstances, given the use of the word obligated that you've talked about? I just think it's much too severe a morality for anybody to be with. I think we might praise him as a hero if he did it, but I certainly don't think that the word obligation is correct there. And that then leads us to the question as to whether or not when we talk about utilitarianism, we really want to phrase it in terms of the duty to engage in those steps which improve the overall system, as opposed to an institutional framework which allows people to do things, exchanges or whatever, without having these consequences that do it. And just to finish it up, I just think it's a very bad way, and I think Williams is just completely wrong about this, to try to figure out what basic social institutions look like by looking at very weird cases of necessity. This is the Judith Jarvis Thompson case and lots of others. It's not that we don't have to solve them, but I do think, in effect, that we don't want to see that somehow or other the choice we make about this case is going to influence the question of whether or not we regulate the price of bread or something like that.
Well, right. So he's complaining about consequentialism, not about utilitarianism.
Well, I'm a consequentialist,
but if you don't like that case, then jigger it so that you do see that the consequentially utilitarianly focused person seems as though they get no leave but to do the dirty hands thing lest the skies fall or something like that. And the question is,
why do we have to feel an obligation to do something? The quote that you have here from Morris, to me at least, mechanism here is something with values. If I'm walking down there, I have no particular value of one person's life or 20 persons' life. I'm not involved in the situation. I walk away. I don't feel any guilt because I don't value these people.
Or even if I do, I don't feel I have a duty to rescue, which is the standard.
I mean, this would be a long discussion, and I only have another 5 minutes or so. But there's rejecting the particular case, and there are certainly people out there who will defend the view that Williams is attacked. Okay, so that's one thing to say in his defense, but that's not the interesting thing. The interesting thing is that if you don't, you are, if you think that what really is driving ethics here is a concern for, say, general happiness, there'd be a Millian about this, who Mill is, I don't think, any sort of consequentialist about these sorts of things, but he does think there is at least a way of reading him where what he thinks is that it's really happiness that is the basis of ethics. If you think that, then it does seem that you are prone to cases where the thing that you thought was at stake in ethics in general is now within the causal levers that are in front of you, and you make the epistemic situation as clear as possible, right? At that point, if you fail to pull the lever that seems like it is going for the thing that you thought was in ethics, at stake in ethics anyway, it seems as though you are being inconsistent. Now, if you are a rule utilitarian and you're saying, well, what we are really going for here are the rules rather than the acts of individuals, then you might get yourself some defense there. But Smart's point, which is the simpleton view, is just jigger the cases again in some other way, and you'll end up in a case where it doesn't make sense to follow the rules. And so,
I mean, it's a long discussion. I'll listen to it.
Maybe this is just a terminological point, but if you look at your extreme non-practical guilt case, where somebody might start out with guilty feelings, maybe it's for an act that they had no involvement with, there's no responsibility, what would you think about framing it in this way, that feelings might start out as guilty feelings, and then if some of the discussion is highlighted, after thinking about different ways of resolving the situation, there's just no possible resolution. I wonder if you could say then that the feeling at the end of that deliberation is maybe a remainder of shame. Others have obviously drawn the distinction between shame and guilt. So would that affect your description of that?
There's, as you mentioned, a lot of discussion around that, of which I'm only slightly aware of some of it. And I don't have a quick response to that. I'd want to think about it a little harder. I think that the point of feeling guilty here is that it does seem as though something that you benefit from or are part of is causally responsible for harm to others. And I guess the immediate thought about shame does not usually or necessarily involve harm to others. And so if you couldn't come up with any reason why anybody else was either harmed or at risk of harm, then I'm not sure why that remainder would still be there, or I might be more inclined to think, as Martha does, that would be an irrational thought at that point. John?
Say again how you came down on survivor guilt, and in particular, it's survivor guilt where you've survived some natural disaster, like you're the only one in the family that escaped from the earthquake that toppled your house, everyone else was crushed in the house, but somehow you managed to.
How did I come down on that?
That in terms of it's being rational, yeah, or irrational, in terms of it's involving the breach of a ethical relation or something?
Well, I guess, largely irrational, but, here's a reason why it might not be entirely crazy for somebody to feel this way. Suppose, right, that the difference, that the underlying cause of the thing was something with, say, house construction, which...
We want a case where you've survived,
right?
And it's just sheer luck. So, unless I misunderstand where you're going, the house construction involves finding fault somewhere.
Fault or something from which one has benefited in some way. I would suppose survivor guilt is irrational in these cases of nothing but luck.
And so, in that sense, you're going to differ from Morris. Who thinks this is non-moral guilt, but it's not subject to the evaluation of being irrational. That's perfectly fine. I'm just trying to sort of chart out where you were,
right,
versus where Morris is.
Yeah, I should be clear on that.
Because that's one of his cases of non-moral guilt.
and his argument is not moral guilt. It's a kind of guilt which is perfectly, there's no criticism of your rationality in your experience.
So I guess here, let me go back to what I was saying about ethical connectedness here, right? It's, there is a sense in which if your luck has made you in a differential position with respect to everybody else, and there is absolutely nothing that was to have been done or that could be done after the fact that would repair that kind of breach. I should think a little harder about that and say something more concrete about it. If I recall, your response to that discussion is to give some sort of analysis in terms of the practices on this. I might even agree with you here that what's going on here is a kind of application of practices that are otherwise justified elsewhere to this case. But in some sense, I think that'll end up making it irrational since the practices don't really apply. But I don't know.
Thank you so much, Scott. This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.